Yeah, I noticed that all your electronics and that have been working kind of weird, slow and whatever. Supposedly, there's a lot of solar storms going on right now. Yeah, so it's like sunbursts, like us, whatever they're called, flares, solar flares, or seem to be lots of them lately. I guess Northern Lights are way up, so I'm wondering if it's affecting that. Did you check it? Okay. I figured out what the problem was. So, oh. No way we go. Okay. What? Oh, it might help if you push the right button, Brian. There we go. Oh, jeez Louise. There. Okay. So we did cardiovascular stuff. So we have one set of lectures that relates to the cardiovascular system to go, and that is peripheral vascular disease. Have you heard of this before? Yes, come across it. Did you do it in theory class? Did you treat it in theory or in lab? Like not treat it, but work with it or discuss it in lab? Oh, in theory. Okay. All right. Okay. So. Also, short form is PVD, and this pretty much encompasses conditions of blood vessels supplying the extremities, major abdominal organs, and most often in the intestines and the kidneys. So it's, you know, anything that affects the vessels themselves, hence, of course, it makes its name vascular disease. It's organized based on the underlying pathological findings, so it could be inflammatory. It could be arterial occlusive, venous, or vasomotor disorders. So, you know, inflammation speaks to itself. Arterial occlusive, something that's narrowing the diameter of the vessel, and venous or vasomotor disorders, so anything in the venous system or the tunica media in terms of having spasms and narrowing blood vessels down. So in other words, it's a grouping of disorders of both the arterial and the venous vessels. More often, it affects the legs more than the arms. That has to do a little bit with the influence of gravity, of course, in terms of how it's affecting them. And we get something that can be called intermittent claudication. And this results in muscle pain that happens when you're active and stops when you're at rest. So this is claudication means what? Okay, and what else? It causes pain in the leg. Claudication is actually the closing or blocking of a vessel due to narrowing of it, a blood clot, those sorts of things. So as it's no different than heart disease, when muscle demand goes up, if there's not enough blood to meet the need of the muscle, it hurts, right? It's painful. So we can see here that you know, we've got peripheral vascular disease is a condition where there is scarring and narrowing of the peripheral blood vessels, veins, and arteries, like those in the legs. Eventually, blood vessels become small and stiff, making it very difficult for blood to get from the extremities and from the extremities. So, PVD, of course, is the vein, and it sometimes gets put as PAD. So, PVD being rather peripheral vascular insufficiency or disease, it's the vein. PAD represents peripheral artery disease, which is, of course, with the arteries. And we can see that when we have this with veins, you get vacuuming the oxygenated blood back to the heart. So it actually pulls it back, and blood begins to pool in the legs, manifesting as varicose veins. So that's sort of the initial of it. And then when we look at arteries, of course, it's always going away. So this is a good little chart to remind yourself of, you know, what's going on here with PVD. You get voluptuous pulses, edema, irregular shaped sores on the leg, no sharp pain, always dull and aching, yellow and brown ankles. Where when you're looking at the arterial side, you may have absent pulses altogether or very diminished pulses. The legs are cold. The hair falls off at the skin in that distal part of the limb, and the skin becomes very shiny. You can get red sores from blood pooling. You can get toes and feet that go pale or black, which is eschar, and then, of course, sharp calf pain, which can be this intermittent claudication that results in, you know, as the oxygen needs of the muscle go up when you're exercising, blood can't bring enough oxygen, and of course, it really is a form of ischemia is what's happening to the skeletal muscle. So vasculitis, and this is a group of disorders that share a common pathogenesis of inflammation of the blood vessels involving arteries and veins, which of course results in narrowing or occlusion of the lumen or formation of aneurysms that can rupture. So basically it's this inflammation that's the big things, and nerves in this area can be affected as well, which means of course that this can be a very painful condition because the neurons are being affected. It's somewhat a central feature of rheumatoid arthritis and scleroderma, so it tends to associate with it. And of course, it can involve any size vessel, anywhere, any type. So we think of, venules and veins and arteries and arterioles and so forth. Okay, any of them could be affected. It can occur as an isolated peripheral nerve vasculitis, with primary target organ being the muscle, peripheral nerve, skin, testicle, or kidney. So, and obviously everywhere in your body is being having blood delivered to it. So, of course, if you have nerves in that area and the vessels are inflamed and narrowed, of course, it's going to affect wherever it's going. It can be infectious, which we see in Hep B or C or HIV, or non-infectious. And it can be acute or chronic, whether an immune response or it's an autoimmune response. Now, the immune complexes are deposited in the vessel walls, which then, of course, initiates this huge inflammatory reaction to the area where these are accumulating, and then you end up with endothelial damage. So you're getting the normal response, which you'd want at any given time, but because you have these immune complexes that get deposited in the vessel walls, then eventually you get endothelial damage from these immune cells, which results in thickening, and eventually you get occlusion where it gets completely blocked off, and then all kinds of tissue damage in the area. So you can see here, vasculitis can result in, nervous system in a stroke, a myocardial infarct or hypertension. In the digestive system, you can get abdominal pain or bloody stool. In rheumatoid arthritis, it relates to the joint pain, arthritis and inflammation in the joint. In the skin, you get these Levito reticularis or palpable purpura. So you can see here that there's, can be quite obvious as to what's happening here. And there's a lot of, depending on where the vasculitis is, of course, is going to determine the kind of symptomology the patient's going to have. But ultimately, you tend to have fever, headache, or weight loss within it as well. These are the more common types and the associated diseases with them. Now, I'm not going to ask any questions on these associated diseases, but you can see there's quite a few of them, and it's sort of something you can throw into your references for later, because you may have a patient who comes to you and say, "I just got diagnosed with giant cell arteritis. Like, what is that, and what happens to it?" Now, the other one is called polyarteritis nodosa, and this is multiple sites of inflammation and destructive lesions in the arterial system. So you get this small spots of inflammation that's occurring. And these lesions that result are these nodes or projections of tissue that sort of affect in the vessels themselves. Causes unknown, but we think of it possibly being infectious in nature. And polyarteritis occurs more commonly in IV drug users. So, the damage that gets done to it. I know in the past when I had to do phlebotomy, and I would have people who are drug users, and when you put the needle into the vessel, it actually gets crunchy. It actually has like a crunchy thickness to it that you really kind of have to push a little more aggressively to get the needle into the vessel. The first time you do it, you go, "Did I just feel that?" Because it literally goes... You can feel it kind of crunching in. It affects both small and medium blood vessels with a variety of clinical presentations, of course, depending on where it is. But the likely symptoms, because you've got this inflammatory response, fever, chills, tachycardia, arthralgias, and myositis. Any organ can be affected, but the most common are the kidneys, heart, liver, GI tract, muscles, and testes. Okay? You can get pericarditis or myocarditis as a result of this condition as well, and that's just telling you that the heart vessels have been involved and the heart itself. Multiple asymmetric neuropathies, motor and sensory distribution can occur, when the vasculitis affects the arteries of the peripheral nerves. Remember, nerves have to be fed, right? They're a cell. They need blood supply. So they are affected if blood supply is limited to them because their metabolic needs won't be met. So therefore, if you're going to have peripheral nerves involved, you end up with paresthesias, pain, weakness, and sensory loss. And this represents 75% of patients who are diagnosed with this condition. Thromboangitis obliterans. Now, Berger's disease. You guys have done this in theory, yes? Because I think it's one of the ones that we need, you know, it's sort of on our list for theory class. It's an inflammatory and thrombotic process that affects these peripheral blood vessels and mostly in the extremities. And it can involve either veins or arteries in its progression. We're not sure what the cause is, but the research shows that men approximately around 25 to 35 and heavy smokers tend to see this more often. We get these inflammatory lesions, and then we get a thrombus formation and a resulting vasospasm, which ends up occluding and eventually obliterating small to medium-sized blood vessels of the feet and hands. What's a thrombus? Blood clot. Okay, so we can see here where you actually start getting dying tissue. So you can see the blackness happening here because these obliterated obstructed blood vessels can no longer supply the tissues into here. And of course, if it's bad enough, what are you going to have to do to those fingers? Chop them off. Okay. Symptoms are episodic and segmental. They come and go. They can be in different anatomic locations within the area. Plantar, tibial, and digital vessels are most commonly affected in the lower leg and foot. Now, you can get intermittent claudication, which we find in the arch of the foot or the palm of the hand, which is quite often the first symptom that tends to occur with it. So here my question is, so you guys know what Raynaud's disease is, okay? So what would be the difference between Raynaud's and this? What do you think? Right. Do you know how I always remembered? Do you remember how I always remembered Raynaud's? Do you remember the popsicles that are red, white, and blue? That's Raynaud's. Because that's what happens. It goes white, then it goes blue, then it goes red. When you get the reactive vasodilation afterwards. So I always remembered Rocket's. Always reminded me of Raynaud's. When we look at hands that are affected, usually the digital, palmar, and ulnar arteries are most commonly involved. Pain at rest, of course, is this persistent ischemia of one or more digits because obliterans is exactly what it says. To obliterate means literally there's no blood vessel really much there anymore and the tissue is going to die. You can get edema, cold sensitivity, rubor. What's rubor? Right? That's an old word, right? That's an old term. Redness, yeah. We used to use that when I went to school, but you don't hear it too much anymore. Cyanosis, thin, shiny, hairless skin from chronic ischemia. It is one of those interesting things that happens to skin with chronic ischemia, where it gets really shiny, and I mean shiny. It looks like somebody's put oil on it, and all the hair falls out. Arteriosclerosis obliterans, which is peripheral artery disease. This is an arterial sclerosis in which proliferation of the intima has caused complete obliteration of the lumen. This is also used to be known as atherosclerotic occlusive disease, chronic occlusive arterial disease, obliterative arteriosclerosis, and PAD. So it can go by a number of names. Basically, it's the most common arterial occlusive disease of all of them. So 95% of cases tend to be this. What happens is you get ischemic ulcers in the leg and feet because of the lack of blood, so that the tissue actually starts breaking down, right? And you also tend to see this most often in people with diabetes mellitus because, again, the peripheral arteries are being damaged and they're not functioning properly. And quite often in people with DM, this is resulting in an amputation because there's no way they can save the area. So, and people with diabetes, unfortunately, it starts, it's a toe, then it's toes, then it might be the foot, and then it might be the lower leg and so forth as it works its way through. Smoking is the more potent risk factor for PAD, as well as atherosclerosis as the underlying cause. PAD are more likely to have CAD and cerebral vascular disease than those without PAD, and it kind of makes sense, right? You've got the inflammatory and all these damage, why wouldn't the vessels around the heart be affected as well? Basically, quite often, this is considered to be a progression of atherosclerosis. So we see this, this whole reaction here, and you start seeing this narrowed artery and fatty substances in the wall. So you can see how it associates the coronary artery disease. Peripheral artery disease, again, this claudication, they tend to appear in when the diameter of the vessel is narrowed by 50% or more. In other words, if someone has this, it's not until it gets to 50%. They could be carrying this disease for some time, and it's not until it reaches that 50% point. The thing to remember from that as well, that 50%, also relates to coronary artery disease. A patient can have 50% occlusion of coronary arteries and have no symptomology. But a big enough clot comes along and gets caught in that occlusion, you have an MI. That's, remember I said, quite often people, their first symptom of heart disease is that actual heart attack happening. It's because we're able to get to this 50%. PAD affecting lower extremities is primarily one of the large and medium arteries and usually branch points and bifurcations. And what happens is, because we're talking about arterial disease here, symptomology occurs distal to the site, which makes sense, right? If blood's traveling to feed a particular tissue, proximally, you're going to have the occlusion, and of course, distally, the tissues that are being fed by the artery aren't being fed by the artery because it's occluded. Acute ischemia may present with some or all the classic symptoms, such as pain, with cramping and or burning, pallor, paresthesia, paralysis, and pulselessness. Have you guys palpated the dorsalis pedis?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah, did you find it easy? On the top of the foot? Yeah. Did you find it? In hospital setting, quite often, what they'll do is they bring in a little tiny ultrasound to listen to it, because it can be a bit of a bugger artery to find. So if someone has damage proximally on a leg, like a really badly broken leg in a car accident or something, they'll put the ultrasound on dorsalis pedis to see if there's a pulse there. And if not, obviously, something's preventing blood from moving down. If someone has this, the distance a person can walk before the onset of pain indicates the degree of circulatory inadequacy. They may only feel a sense of weakness or tiredness, but both of these are relieved by rest. So the patient's going to say, when I walk, it hurts, and when I sit down, the pain goes away. I start walking, it hurts, I sit down, the pain goes away. Because what's happening is you're increasing tissue demand. By walking, the muscle's asking for more, the vessel's affected, so the tissue hurts. When you stop walking, the demand for the tissue goes down and there's enough to supply and we don't get the pain. In tibial and common perineal involvement, the smaller digital vessels can be involved, and arterial ulcers over bony prominences can develop as a result of ischemia. The skin can become shiny and atrophic, and fissures and cracks can appear. If there's still pain at rest, you've got a more serious involvement. Relief can sometimes be achieved by dangling the affected limb over the edge of a bed. Why? Why would that work? Gravity is going to push arterial blood down into the tissues, right? Thrombophlebitis. This is the swelling of a vein due to vein wall inflammation. A phlebitis means vein wall inflammation as a result of a blood clot and deposition in the vein. And it, depending on the depth of the location, there are two different types. There's a deep vein thrombosis and there's a superficial thrombophlebitis. Have you guys learned the test for a DVT? What's it called? And how do you do it? So you can see here, you've got a thrombophlebitis here because of a needle that was maybe for phlebotomy. The technician put the needle in and had it. And then this is when we look at superficial thrombophlebitis, we can see we get this redness just under the skin here. And when we look at, we can see it here superficially, you know, can be quite affected by the skin. So a DVT is a partial occlusion or a complete occlusion of a vein by a thrombus with secondary inflammatory reaction in the wall of the vein. So you get this inflamed vein, then you get this occlusion that occurs. This venous thrombus is a collection of fibrin network, platelets, erythrocytes, and leukocytes. And of course, these all activate the clotting cascade, which results in the formation of a clot at this particular site. Together, and this can produce morbidity and mortality. So what is the danger of massaging a DVT? Death. From what? Right, so you can actually break the clot away and off it goes to where it's going to get stuck, basically, right? Yeah, that's why you do the test, and then that becomes what kind of CI? What kind of CI? General or local? Yeah. Well, for sure it's local. That whole area you wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, right? And if they have not been pre-diagnosed, yes, yeah, I wouldn't touch them again until they got, you know, whatever was going on. Because if it's one there, there could be one somewhere else too, right? Together, the DVT and the pulmonary embolism are referred to as a venous thromboembolism. VTE in the venous system is divided by depth and proximity. So when we look at them, of course, you know, we have these great small saphenous veins, and the deep is divided into the distal deep, which is the anterior tibial, posterior tibial, and peroneal veins, and proximal deep is the popliteal, superficial, femoral, deep femoral, common femoral, and external iliac veins. Any of these can be affected depending on where they are. And, you know, some are larger than others, but ultimately, again, somewhere within that line from distal to proximal, you can develop a DVT, okay? A DVT is classified as distal if it's below the knee and proximal if it's located in the popliteal vein or above. The most common superficial vein thrombosis in the lower extremity is the saphenous vein in the lower leg, and the most common DVT occurs in the femoral or iliac veins proximally. So that's where you generally tend to see them. And I would say, out of all of them, the most common is saphenous. That's where you're going to tend to find them, right? And of course, they're going to express discomfort in that area. In the early stages, half of people are asymptomatic, and lower extremities are affected 90% of the time. If a thrombus occludes a major vein, venous pressure and volume rises distally. Does that make sense? Because the blood has nowhere to go. It's blocked because it's trying to head back to the heart. If a small vessel is occluded, collateral vessels will develop and relieve the volume and pressure. So, again, we can see here, depending on where it is, here's your femoral vein here, and you get an occlusion here. Of course, distal to it's going to be affected. And depending on where you are here, because this represents sort of the normal venous anatomy. Here's the popliteal vein. We've got some anastomoses here in around the knee. We've got the posterior tibial vein here. We've got the anterior tibial veins. Any of these can be occluded. And remembering that, you know, depending on where the occlusion is, distal to it is where you're going to have the symptoms. So femoral, of course, is going to get, you know, mid-thigh or higher, whereas if we get into these lower leg ones, the more distal ones, then our symptomology is going to be farther down the leg, our foot, our ankle, you know, maybe a bit of the shin area. So we end up with some calf swelling. We can get leg warmth, indications that a patient may have this deep vein thrombosis. And, of course, pain and discomfort will be occluded, especially when they say when they're walking and moving, those sorts of things, right? So if we release this thrombus in a DVT, one place it can travel to is in the lung, okay, which can become a pulmonary embolism. This can occur when part of a thrombus in a DVT breaks away and travels through the right side of the heart into a pulmonary artery. Remember, if our thrombus is in the venous system, all venous blood is returning back to the right side of the heart. So, of course, that blood needs to go through pulmonary circulation before it can get to the left side and then to the body. So it's likely if it's large enough and gets to the wrong place, it can result in a pulmonary embolism. This will include any of the pulmonary tissue it serves, and there will be no gaseous exchange within that area. If it occludes a major vein, venous pressure and volume rise distally. If a small vessel is occluded, collateral vessels will develop and relieve the volume and the pressure. But ultimately, a pulmonary embolism or your suspicion of it is a trip to where? The emergency department, right? It is a medical emergency because you can die, okay? PEs almost often are from the large deep veins of the pelvis and legs, and if they are, that's where we get into these really bad situations and can have sudden death. The signs and symptoms of a PE are dependent on the size and location of the PE. It could include pleuritic chest pain, diffuse chest discomfort, tachypnea, hemoptysis, which is coughing or spitting up blood from the respiratory tract, anxiety, restlessness, apprehension, dyspnea, and persistent cough. The first clinical manifestation of a DVT can be just a PE, right, when they start looking backwards as to where did that come from. So we can see here that, here we go into the vein, the inferior vena cava in this case, coming up into the right side, and we can see once it gets into pulmonary circulation, it can catch in any of the vessels that are supplying the lungs, and then you have a problem, and you can see that, you can get, it's traveling up and working its way through, and it collects in the right atrium first, and then, of course, the pressure pushes it up through, and then we get all this occlusion that can occur, and depending on the size of it, it can, affect maybe a small part of the lung, or it can affect a very large part of the lung. It's also my understanding that because of the beating of the heart, these emboli can be broken into smaller pieces, and you can have large multi-vessels that can be occluded in a PE, right? And then, of course, you're in the hospital for a few days with that. Varicose veins. We talked a little bit about them in semester one. It's abnormal dilation of veins, usually the saphenous of the lower extremities, leading to tortuosity. So twisting and turning, you get incompetence of those venous valves, which promote blood towards the heart, and a propensity to result in thrombosis. Women are affected with leg varicosities more often than men because of pregnancy. So the pressure of the fetus down on the iliac veins, that can result in inappropriate return, and you get pooling and accumulation in the legs, which results in this. Family history is associated with this condition, and several genes have been implicated. So if your mom has bad varicose veins, there's a good chance you will as well. It's unclear whether the valvular incompetence is part of the pathological process or the resulting incompetence is due to the dilation of the vessel. What do you think, Sunil? They found any more? We don't know if it's the valves that cause the problem or the problem causes damage to the valves. Or it could be both, really. Right, because your book talks about how it could be one or the other, and they're not sure which is the one that starts the process in the first place. And then you get the back pooling and so forth, yeah. Periods of high venous pressure associated with heavy lifting or prolonged sitting along with pregnancy or obesity, heart failure, hemorrhoids, constipation, esophageal varices, and hepatic cirrhosis can all result. One vein predisposes the client to other veins because you get all this backwards movement of blood, right? So we can see here, and I always found this fascinating, because of the genetic propensity, I have met athletes who are incredible athletes, Olympic-level athletes, and they still get varicose veins. I remember one gentleman in Orillia, great marathon runner, like in phenomenal fitness, and he had huge, torturous veins in his legs, and it just happened to be a family thing. Vessels most commonly affected are located just beneath the skin, superficial, to that deep fascia, which is therefore lack of muscle support, because remember, muscles milk veins, which helps also to return blood back to the heart. So every muscle contraction of the legs is pushing blood upwards. As the valves become more incompetent, the veins become more elastic. They then engorge with stagnant blood and become pools. Any condition accompanied by higher pressure changes places stress on them. But besides the legs, other sites include the hemorrhoidal plexus of the rectum and anal canal, and you can have hemorrhoids externally or internally, depending, either or sometimes both, unfortunately. So you get either or inside or outside the anal sphincter, submucosal veins of the distal esophagus, and the scrotum. Now, if you have esophageal varices, they're very dangerous because if they burst, you can die from that. So they're usually found through a gastroscopy to have a look and see if they're there, and then they get treated accordingly. Very much associated with liver or biliary diseases, cirrhosis of the liver, those sorts of things. Through the backwards movement of blood in the portal system, you get these esophageal varices that occur, and they are much more dangerous than rectal varicosities. Cramps can occur. Development is usually gradual. Most common symptom being dull, achy heaviness, tension, a feeling of fatigue brought on by periods of standing. You can get cramps at night, especially, and elevation of the legs provides relief. So we have something to remember here. In varicose veins, we elevate the legs, and arteriosus or artery diseases, we lower the legs, distinctly different. So in this kind of condition, we drop the legs off the table, whereas when we've got things like varicose veins, we want to elevate the legs to provide relief, okay? So you can see here, the incompetence or insufficiency of those valves, we get accumulated collection of blood, and you then get thinning of the vessels, and you get the stagnant blood that's occurring. There are a couple of different treatments for them. So one is to take a device, and it goes in, it's got a hook, and they tear the vein out. Did I talk about this in semester one a little bit? So think of an arrow. So you've got a vessel that's So they'll take the vein, they'll make an incision proximally. So you've got this vein that's here, and they'll put a device in that when it goes down in the leg, it does this. So the back arrow sort of catches the vein, and they yank the whole vein out the hole. So it gets completely removed altogether. I don't know if that's as common anymore as it used to be. Now there's saline injections that are being used. So they inject saline in. And there's also an ultrasound treatment as well that helps break these down and gets rid of them as well. So there are a couple of options for patients to get rid of them. I have seen this procedure here done, and they're pretty sore. The patient's pretty sore for quite some period of time because they literally yank the entire vein out the hole. Yeah. Because you don't want any blood pooling. It helps along with the muscles to promote blood back so you don't get any stagnation of blood. They'll try the compression stockings first, and if they don't work well, then they may just remove them. Maybe they're just trying to empty it out a little bit before they do it. That could be the reason why they're trying to use the compression stockings to get them cleared out a bit better. Yeah, I'm wondering if that's just promoting getting them cleaned out and getting, yeah, right. Because I would imagine if they were full of blood, it'd be a pretty messy surgery pulling it out. And then you would get accumulated interstitial blood in the limbs and whatnot. So treatment is conservative with periodic daily rest periods, feet elevated above the heart. External massage to direct fluid back towards the heart may help to relieve. Client education should include the understanding of promoting circulation through frequent posture changes, daily exercise program, and the appropriate use of properly fitting elastic stockings. So it's not unusual to provide this to help with return. If past where conservative approaches no longer work, you can have vein stripping, sclerotherapy, which is the injecting of a solution directly in the vein, and the sclerotherapy solution causes the vein to scar, forcing blood to reroute through a healthier vein. And that was done in the past, and there's now new techniques that include laser. It seemed to be very effective at helping with it. So when you go online, I was doing a bit of the research for this initially. You go online, there's lots of options now for therapies for this condition. So you can see here what they do is they put a laser fiber into the vein, and they turn it on, it scars the endothelial lining, and then the vein kind of just scars and closes up, and then it can't be used any longer. Just tell your mom about that. It might be an idea. Because I think that there's lots of clinics out there that offer it. Yes. Yeah, occasionally people with varicose veins do get phlebitis. It can be very, very... I've never come across it, to be quite honest with you. I haven't really seen it. But my understanding is that some people do get, yes, significant phlebitis with it, and it's quite uncomfortable for them. Raynaud's. Raynaud disease and phenomena. Defined as intermittent episodes of small artery or arterial constriction of the extremities, causing temporary pallor and cyanosis of the digit and changes in skin temperature. Does anybody here have it? Okay. It's quite common. I come across it quite a lot, actually. Quite a lot, in especially females. It's very does she as well? Does she have anything like rheumatoid arthritis or anything like that? Yeah, it's very common with RA. But we'll determine which is disease and what clarifies phenomena. It can be in response to cold temperatures or strong emotion, such as anxiety or excitement. Raynaud disease, or primary Raynaud, is a primary vasospastic disorder, which is idiopathic. So we don't know why, but these people, their vessels spasm, close, and go through all these symptoms. Raynaud phenomena, or secondary Raynaud, is secondary to an underlying condition or pathology, like your mom with rheumatoid arthritis. 80% of those with the disease are women between 20 and 49. So far more common in females than it is in males. Exact etiology is unknown, but it does appear to be caused by hypersensitivity of digital arteries to cold. So when the hands are cold, they tend to get this spasm. Risk factors include female gender, family members with Raynaud disease, smoking, and manual occupations. So for example, those who use like jackhammers out on the street and that vibration, that can lead to a propensity for Raynaud's disease. People with Raynaud disease experience migraine 4 times more often than those without disease. I hadn't heard that before. That's why I wrote it out of the book. So, because migraines are a vasospastic disorder, right? You get vasoconstriction first, and then an associated vasodilation, which is what brings the headache on, because you get this huge flush of blood into the brain. So it would make sense if you have vasospastic issues with the hands. That probably does increase your risk of having vasospastic vessels in your head. Yes, and your nose, and your tongue. Yeah, when it's bad enough, it can affect your tongue as well. When a condition is secondary to another disease, it's often associated with Buerger's disease or connective tissue disorders, scleroderma, polymyositis, and dermatomyositis, mixed connective diseases, systemic lupus, and RA, rheumatoid arthritis. And I believe probably with your mom, when she initially got it, they probably did an investigation for RA right at the time. They'll tend to do it for as part of it. So you can see here, it's very distinct. So I'm assuming you took this in Jen's class as well. Did she talk about the sharp border that you get with it? So it's very distinct with Raynaud's. You will have normally colored tissue, and at a very distinct line, they go white. It's just like it's like a boundary right there that really affects it. So you can see it here. Right, you get this sudden to the point where there's almost no blood going into the digit and it turns white. You can even see the bluing of the nails underneath. And I like this picture because it really does show you a very defined border where suddenly there's, on the other side of it, the arteries, that are serving this part of the fingers are no longer functioning properly and they've spasmed closed. There's no blood going there. But what happens is, as the tissue becomes ischemic, of course, then the body sends out vasodilation hormones and chemicals to have it dilate and you get the change. So phenomena may also occur with change in temperature, so warm outside to air-conditioned rooms. Raynaud's phenomena may also be associated with occlusive artery disease, neurogenic lesions such as thoracic outlet syndrome, or with the effect of long-term exposure to colds, such as, you know, the possibility of like being out all the time, or maybe of having previous frostbite, trauma, or use of vibrating machinery like a jackhammer can really set somebody up for this condition. A combination of vascular, neural, and humoral factors is implicated. Now, whether it's a primary disease or secondary, the manifestations still look the same, you know, with this defined border and color. So, it begins with the release of chemical messengers that cause blood vessels to constrict and remain constricted. Oxygenated blood flow is restricted to the areas, the vessel supplies, and the skin becomes cold and white. Right? You feel coldness, and it'll look white. In the constricted vessels, the blood, which has released its O2, pools in the tissue, producing a bluish or purplish color. So you go from white to blue. Again, because the blood is sitting there, but all the oxygen's gone, so it gives that bluish look. The skin color further progresses from blue to white to red. So ischemia from the vasospastic attack causes cyanosis, numbness, and the sensation of cold in the digits. Thumb usually is not affected. It's usually the four digits, the other four. Skin then turns to white as the spasm continues. The flow of the chemical that triggered the spasm stops. Once that stops, the vessels relax, blood flow is restored, and the skin then becomes red as the capillaries are engorged with oxygenated blood. The skin then becomes warm and flushed, and the person may experience throbbing, paresthesia, and light swelling as the blood flow returns. So, white, blue, then red. Cold, then hot. Okay? In severe chronic Raynaud phenomena, the underlying condition can cause scarring in the vessels, which further reduces vessel diameter, which of course equals reduced blood flow. If the attacks are more severe with prolonged loss of blood to fingers and toes, you can end up with skin ulcers. In other words, the tissues around the fingers and that starts breaking down. Raynaud disease is often bilateral, progressing distally to proximal along the digits, and Raynaud phenomena can be unilateral, involving one or two fingers. So it's both hands, it's Raynaud's disease. If it's unilateral in one hand only or one digit only, then you're into the phenomenon. Okay, so there you go. White, blue, then red. Rocket popsicles. You guys are like, what are you talking about? Oh, you've seen them? Okay. circulatory shock, so often referred to just as shock. It's a severe circulatory failure, and you end up with underperfusion of peripheral tissues. So suddenly, they're not getting anything. It can develop due to a variety of conditions. Shock is associated with marked reduction of blood flow to vital organs, which eventually leads to cell damage because of the lack of O2 and eventually death. So, anybody here had anybody who's gone into shock? Bad injury or? Did you? Interesting. So, three stages. First, you get compensated hypotension as a result of a reduced cardiac output that stimulates compensatory mechanisms. And this results in altered myocardial function and peripheral resistance. So what's happening is you're basically peripherally shutting down so that blood gets into the center of the body to help the organs. So it's like there's this, the body deliberately says, well, I want all the blood to go central. We'll worry about the arms and the legs later. Also happens in heart attacks. This is why patients go gray, because all the blood goes to where the heart's screaming for oxygen and leaves the peripheral hands and feet. Then, the compensatory neck mechanism, stage two, the compensatory mechanisms that tried to correct the low delivery of O2 gets overwhelmed and tissue perfusion is decreased. You start then seeing early signs of cerebral, renal, and myocardial insufficiency. So now you're running into, you're kind of ramping up the problem. Here's what's happening. You have cardiogenic shock that can occur, which, of course, your cardiac function is precipitously dropping, and this can result from disorders of the heart muscle, valves, or electrical pacing system. And then if it's not dealt with, you go into stage three, where you get severe ischemia with damage to kidneys, liver, and lungs. Ischemia of the GI tract allows for ulcerations and the invasion of bacteria. My understanding is that if you get to this point, those ulcers show up very, very quickly. This is not something that happens 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 days later. It's happening within hours if it's not dealt with. Clinical manifestations include, in the early stage, tachycardia, increased respiratory rate, and distended neck veins. If it continues on, you get hypoperfusion, which recurs with cold skin, weak pulse, hypotension, mottled extremities with weak or absent peripheral pulses, and collapsed neck veins. If you go into late shock, it's usually you're not able to bring them back, and cardiac collapse occurs and the patient dies. So quite often in early shock, patients will express, "I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine." And they really should be treated appropriately because it can advance quite quickly into stage three and not be very good. So this is the map out as to what happens. And you can see on this, not that you need to know this by any means, but what I want you to understand from this, like literally a bad cut can result in you dying from shock, not the cut. Because as you can see in this, everything gets affected. Adrenal cortex, heart, lungs, kidneys, liver, brain, like everything just starts to go wacky. And it just leads you down the road to cardiogenic shock and death. Not bad. Do you guys want to take a break now? Or do you want to wait? Take a break. Okay. When is Diwali? It's a Sunday. Okay. What calendar do Indians follow? And so what's it based on? Like seven days a week or? Oh, okay.
But the duration of year is the same.
Yes.
But we are like almost 32, 30, 30, 30, no, 2050, this is 2057 right now.
Okay.
So we are like 24 years old.
Interesting. People forget that we only follow someone's philosophy for time and dates. They just think everybody follows it in the world, and no. Wow. Okay. Interesting. Okay. You've all heard this term before, lymphedema. So of course, interstitial fluid created by ultrafiltration at the capillary beds is taken up by lymphatic vessels and into larger collecting ducts, which eventually ends up in the blood via the subclavian veins. So we have, if you remember me talking about this in FIS, in cardiac, you know, you have blood that goes into the peripheral capillaries, and at that point where gaseous exchange occurs, you also have fluid movement. So you have osmotic fluid movement out of capillaries, And one would expect osmotic fluid to travel, laws would travel, have fluid travel back into capillaries, and it doesn't so much for a number of reasons. So we need the lymphatic system, I kind of call it the wet back, that sucks up the excess leaking capillaries to ensure that there's no collection of fluid, interstitial fluids, and of course those terminal ends of those lymphatics suck up the fluid and it works its way back into the cardiovascular system. So it's a one-way system which helps maintain fluid balance in the tissues, fight infections, and assist in the removal of cellular debris. So not only is the lymphatic system maintaining fluid levels, but it's also part of the immune response, so it captures anything it's invading within the context of the lymph nodes and so forth, where we get an immune response. And of course, then dead and dying cells and debris always goes up as well. Fluid leaves the capillary bed via diffusion and ultrafiltration, so nourishing the tissues. And with diffusion, two ways in ultrafiltration, one way only out. So we don't get the same in as we get out. So anything that's going to damage or affect the lymphatic system means you're going to have lymphedema and collection of inner fluid within the interstitial tissues simply because it's not picking, lymphatic system is not picking up the excess. Fluid from ultrafiltration is picked up by the lymph system along with the majority of extracellular protein. It is pressure driven. If mechanisms are disrupted, such as scar tissue, node damage, removal of nodes, reduced muscle pumping, you get accumulations of water and protein that remain in the tissue. And that can be latent, acute, or chronic lymphedema. So ultimately, but I might be losing my headset here. I apologize because I don't know why it's dying out of me early today. Ultimately, anything that affects this pressure difference, then it's going to collect. And this is to the extent of fluid that can be created if this system is unable to pick up the excess fluid. So you can see through the X-ray here the significant amount of fluid accumulation in the interstitial fluids in this leg, which means, of course, that the more proximal lymph system and the ones associated with the leg are not picking up the excess. And this is how quickly you can pick up fluid. The lymph system collects a lot of fluid at any given time. So the definition of lymphedema is swelling of soft tissue as a result of accumulation of protein-rich fluids in the extracellular spaces, and it can be accompanied by tissue fibrosis. So you end up with chronic inflammation because of this prolonged swelling in the tissue. It is classified under two primary categories or broad categories: primary, which is idiopathic, it just occurs, we don't know why, and secondary, which means it's acquired due to things like having lymph nodes removed, those sorts of things, and cancer treatments. Severity is graded 0, stage 1, stage 2, and lymphostatic elephantiasis. I didn't know we still called it that, but I guess you do, because you look like an elephant leg, right? Basically, which is stage 3. So stage 0 is called latent lymphedema. So you have some impairment of lymph transport, really no swelling occurring, but you need blockage or affected lack of movement of lymph of 30% or greater in order to have swelling happening. So you could have some impairment to lymph return, but if it's less than 30%, you're likely not going to see any swelling. So therefore, it's stage 0. Stage 1, the tissue is soft. It pits on pressure and reverses with elevation. Early is inflammation due to excessive protein. Subcutaneous tissue starts to fibrosing and can progress into stage 2. A couple of years ago, I did have stage 1, and for the life of me, I have no idea why. We drove out to Calgary, so I was in the car having extended driving periods, and I'd have to take my shoes off. My feet would get so big. And when we pulled the trailer over that night while my partner was cooking, she was cooking dinner, I'd get in bed and put my feet up on the walls, and then, of course, it would all drain out. But to this day, I don't know why I collected it. And it was pitted. I could push in my foot, and that pit would stay there for a considerable period of time. So I don't know why it was there. Haven't had it since. Stage 2, it's non-pitting. There's no resolution with elevation and fibrosis that's present. So in stage 1, if I push on the tissue, it'll stay indented. In stage 2, I can push on the tissue, and the indentation will not stay. It just chills right back up again. Atrophic skin changes, so again, loss of hair and dryness. You can get lymph fistula, which are tracts that that can happen. So you have these leaky kind of tracts coming out. Stage three is this lymphostatic elephantiasis. You get severe non-pitting fibrotic edema with hyperkeratosis, which ends up resulting in increased thickness of the stratum corneum. So you actually get skin thickness. You can get papillomas in there, which are a wart-like growth, skin folds with tissue flaps, and leaking lymph fistula. So you can see here that this is stage one. We can see here in the left leg. Stage two, this would be, again, you'd have some pitting here. Stage three, you can see the colorization change. It would not be pitted. And then stage four, you can see the excessive amount of fluid retention that's occurring here. It's the same in the arm. And where we tend to see it in the upper limbs, of course, is post radical mastectomies with lymph node removal and so forth. So again, stage one all the way to stage five, likely, I would say in this case, probably due to some removal of breast tissue and lymphatics and associated breast cancer that we can get this. Can we affect this in massage? Can we change this? Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Not so much with stage four. We can affect some change, but certainly can deal with stage one to three. We can affect a considerable amount of change and get their limbs back to normal. And there actually is a particular type of technique that we don't teach here. It's postgraduate work, and it's called VODER, V-O-D-D-E-R. No, it's beyond MLD. VODER techniques is all based on lymph, and it's postgraduate work. You can't do VODER techniques unless you're a VODER therapist. It might be a form of MLD. Yeah, fair enough. It's a form of MLD, but VODER is kind of the popular one that everybody takes. Yes, but definitely done after graduation. You can do it. Incidents associated with COD. So medical procedures in the upper extremity. So you get this in anywhere from 0 to 5% after a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And what that is the patient may have breast cancer. And during a surgical procedure such as a lumpectomy, the surgeon will go into the lymph change in the axillary region and take little needles full of lymph tissue to see if there's any cancer cells within there. That's what that means. 13% after axillary lymph node dissection, so actually cutting open the lymph nodes. 22% after surgery with irradiation, so if they've had a surgical procedure on the breast along with irradiation, it starts to go up. 75% of breast cancer-related lymphedema. So if you get a significant amount of lymph involvement in breast cancer, you have a 75% chance of ending up with edema in the upper limb. Chemotherapy plus radiation creates even a higher risk. And the greatest risk is if you've had a number of these procedures to deal with your breast cancer, greater than a 25% increase on that. So, you know, anybody who's had a significant invasive procedure done on the breast tissue and in the axillary region, they're very, very likely to have lymphedema in the upper limb of the affected site. Lower extremity, 32% or so when you have inguinal lymph node dissection due to melanomas, 4% after prostate cancer, 8% after prostate cancer with inguinal node dissection, and 16% prostate if no dissection and radiation treatment. So, again, these individuals will end up with lower limb edema as a result of the affected change. So, when we look at etiological factors, so primary lymphedema, we don't know why it happens. Most likely the result of lymphangiodysplasias, like in other words, the cells within the lymph node, something's happening to them, they change. And how do you pronounce that? Can you pronounce that? Okay. It's a big word. Or malformations at birth. There are three types of malformations. You can get aplastic type of malformation, which they're genetically, they don't have any way to collect lymph. Hypoplastic, well, less than normal amount. And most common is a hyperplastic. They have grossly dilated and enlarged lymphatics, which, again, because it's pressure influence, if they're so enlarged, the pressures don't allow for good drainage. Secondary is a result of known damage to normal lymphatic whether that's the nodes in one or more regions. Most common is filariasis, and that is a parasitic worm from mosquitoes. We in Canada are very fortunate because we don't really have it as much, but if you get around the equator, both north and south, and then a little more south, it's everywhere. That's my understanding. It's a considerable problem. Yeah. Yeah. Really? Interesting. What happens is the larva is injected into the dermis when the mosquito bites. It then passes into the lymphatics, and these can grow 20 centimeters in length to be 1 to 2 diameters in diameter, which most North Americans would be totally grossed out by the thought that they have a worm swimming in their lymphatics. Worm dies within 5 to 10 years, and then the worm proteins cause severe local inflammation, which leads to fibrosis and scarring, which leads to even more lymphedema because there's so much damage done to the tissues themselves. This doesn't exist here. The primary cause for it up here in Canada or North America is basically invasive procedures, which we talked about, bacterial infection, abdominal surgeries, or any trauma to the area can result in it. Pathogenesis. So it is a low flow, high protein edema that occurs when the lymph transport capacity is inadequate to recycle proteins and transport a normal amount of lymph failure safety valve mechanisms. So you might want to highlight that because that's ultimately the pure definition of what is the cause here. Lymph node normal, you can have normal lymph load that's happening, but the transport capacity is inadequate. So you're getting lymph that is picking up the fluid, but the transport system is very, very poor. Chronic inflammation, you get this in the edematous tissues. And of course, when you have chronic inflammation, you get protein deposition and you run into fibrotic tight tissues and all kinds of problems. You get infection or delayed wound healing that can occur. So this can be either primary or secondary due to low O2 states of the tissues. You can have lymph pump deterioration. So there is a slight muscular wall, lymphatic vessels, but it hypertrophies and then gets hard. So therefore, that prevents any kind of flow. Impaired transport mechanisms. So lymphedema can cause proliferation of small blood vessels that leak further, overloading the area. So by that happening, then all of a sudden you have so much fluid accumulation in the interstitial tissues that lymphatics can't draw it up and get rid of it. You can have structural impairment, so age and damaged blood vessels associated with structural impairment. When no flaps no longer meet within the lymph system, then you get reflux, meaning you get backflow back to where it started. And that flap, do you remember the one-way flap at the very terminal end of the lymph? Do you remember that? So high pressure outside the lymph, the flap opens, fluid goes in, higher pressure inside the lymph vessel, the pressure is higher, so it closes the flap. Those flaps at the terminal ends become useless, shall we say, or not functioning properly. Then you get all this black backflow of lymph fluid flowing all the way back in the interstitial fluids, and then you start this whole accumulation process. Functional impairment, anything that causes lack of variation in total pressure, such as bed rest, paralysis, prolonged immobility, which results in less changes of pressures, which forces the lymphatic pump to be inactive. This is one of the reasons why, no matter how significant a surgery you've had, there you're up out of that bed and they want you moving because all this starts happening. It can be a real, real problem. Complications, of course, you can get atrophic skin changes due to the low oxygen, so loss of hair in the area, sweat glands, keratotic patches, papillomas, leakage of lymph. The lower extremities can become involved, so the buttocks, genitals, and intestines with reflux of intestinal chyle. Remember, intestinal chyle was how the body removes lipids out of what we eat. And remember, this chyle is like milky white because of the fats, and then this is how we process fats. So you get it leaking back into the gut, which is the problem, through fistulae on the genitals, buttocks or legs, or in the abdomen or thoracic cavity. I just think about putting fistula photographs in the slides because they can be kind of gross, like really gross. So now we're going to the blood tissues. So blood pathologies. We have, of course, this involves the blood itself or blood-forming tissues. And we have to remember there's two components to blood. We have blood plasma and we have formed elements. In other words, blood plasma is the liquid and the formed elements are solids, which include red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. So blood is always both, right? We've got a fluid and we have a solid. The hematologic system is integrated with lymphatic and immune systems. Well, you've got lymphatic sort of buried in the network of capillaries doing their job, so they very much work together. Lymphoid organs are sites for proliferation residence, differentiation of functional lymphocytes, and mononuclear phagocytes. When we have circulatory disorders, they can be characterized by edema, which is, again, the excessive fluid, congestion, accumulation of excessive blood within the blood vessels of an organ or tissue. So either of these things can happen. So we have lymphedema that's related directly to the lymph system being a problem, but we can also have lymphedema as a result of the hematologic system not functioning properly because of the association between the two. So just a couple of terms here. Of course, infarction is localized region of necrosis or death. A thrombus is a solid mass of clotted blood within an intact blood vessel or chamber of the heart. Lymphedema, we've already talked about, which is, you know, swelling of an area from accumulation of interstitial fluid. Bleeding and bruising, of course, trauma, minor trauma like brushing teeth or bleeding continues longer than normal. We start thinking about disorders of blood, right, if you're unable to clot properly, those sorts of things. Shock, we've already talked about. Lymphadenopathies are abnormal enlargement of the lymph node. The normal, of course, they feel rubbery, mobile, and small, but when they're inflamed, they can become tender, warm, and very, very large. If they happen to be malignant, the key concern, if you think they're malignant, it's not tender or mobile, and it's firm and enlarged, so you can't move it. So even if you have an inflamed lymph node, you can usually move it around and feel for it. If it's malignant, it doesn't move, and it's hard as a rock. It's just not a good thing. And splenomegaly, of course, is an over-enlargement of the spleen, which is quite common in many hematologic pathologies or diseases. So the first is called hemochromatosis. And I just discovered one of the guys I play curl with, someone said to me, oh, do you know that Bruce has to go into the hospital every couple of months and have blood taken away from him? I'm like, oh, hemochromatosis. Okay. And it's funny. He's very flushed all the time. His face looks almost like he has hypertension all the time. This is a disorder of excessive iron absorption by the intestine. So we know that anemia, which is far more common, means you have a lack, right? This is a condition where you have too much iron, and that becomes a problem. It is hereditary. It can be present. It is present at birth, but it's usually asymptomatic until you start having these overload problems between 40 and 60 years. I think Bruce is about 60 now. Men experience symptoms 5 to 10 times more than women. And the reason is because pregnancy and definitely menstruation and the loss of blood helps maintain, because even if they are over collecting iron, the fact that you menstruate every month keeps the levels relatively down and therefore generally tend to be asymptomatic. Pathogenesis caused by mutations in the genes of any of the proteins that regulate the entry of iron into the blood. And of course, the severity is completely genetically predetermined in terms of how much that's affected. Normally you get absorption equals body requirements. So, you know, as your body requires iron, you absorb it and everything's fine. But this is uncoupling between absorption and body needs. So the body needs, there's far more iron than the body needs, and you get accumulations. Excess iron is slowly deposited into cells, especially in the liver, heart, and pancreas. So what happens because of that? You get weakness, chronic fatigue, myalgias, joint pain, especially second and third MCP, abdominal pain, hepatomegaly, which is an enlarged liver, elevated hemoglobin, and elevated liver enzymes. So you continue to overload, and you end up with tissue damage. So what happens is the liver starts getting damaged because there's so much iron that's accumulated in it. And without treatment, you get cirrhosis and liver cancer can happen. Right? I know people always associate cirrhosis with drinking, but many other things cause cirrhosis of the liver, which we'll be talking about. Other complications, diabetes, mellitus can occur because of this, cardiomyopathies, bronzing of the skin, destructive arthritis, and impotence in men, and decreased libido in females can be the result of this overaccumulation of iron. So quite literally, you'll look at, I don't know what color it is, Sunil, what it would look like, but there's color changes to the liver where you get these massive deposits of excess iron in the liver itself. Anemias, which is the exact opposite. So hemochromatosis is excessive iron. Anemias are lack of iron. So pathological state resulting in reduction of the ability of blood to carry oxygen because we need iron in order to create hemoglobin. And hemoglobin, of course, is carrying iron, so therefore, right? It's not a disease, but a symptom of many other diseases, such as dietary deficiencies with folate or B12, acute or chronic blood loss, congenital defects of hemoglobin like sickle cell, industrial poisons, diseases of bone marrow, chronic inflammatory, infectious or neoplastic diseases. So anemia is always investigated for cause to make sure it's not any of these more serious reasons why. Three main pathological states. First is blood loss. Second could be decreased production of erythrocytes. And third is peripheral destruction of erythrocytes. And they are described according to the cellular morphology. Page 692, box 14.4 is what you want to have a look at. Excessive blood loss. So you're anemic. You're not feeling well. You're going to emerge. They do a blood cell count where they take blood out of your arm and they do a blood cell count to discover that, you know, there's not a lot of blood cells. So excessive blood loss results in, a lack of erythrocytes. So like a GI bleed from medication, aspirin, NSAIDs, or something like an ulcer, GI cancers, hemorrhoids, diverticulitis, ulcerative colitis, and colon pops. A friend of mine in his 50s, he went into the hospital and they took his blood cell counts and hemoglobin, and it was unbelievably low. And he was tired. He couldn't function well. They did a number of tests. They couldn't find anything. So they finally decided to do a colonoscopy. And I heard that they were the largest polyps that they'd ever seen. And they figured that he probably had symptoms for 2 years and disregarded and ignored them, and they were all turned cancerous. And unfortunately, he lasted 5 years, but yeah, it affected him. Destructive erythrocytes, also known as hemolysis. This can be congenital or acquired. So congenital red blood cell membrane abnormalities or lack of required enzymes or a self-destruction of an autoimmune process or infections. You can get autoimmune hemolytic anemia, where you get autobodies that attach to the red blood cells, killing them. So for some reason, the body sees its own blood as being a bad guy, and it gets attacked and destroys them. So when we have a decreased production of erythrocytes, it's usually the result of a patient who doesn't have enough erythropoietin. So it's not stimulating the red bone marrow to create red blood cells enough. Or you have an inability of the marrow to respond to the EPO. That could be due to a nutrient deficiency or chronic diseases, again, like rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus, tuberculosis, or cancer. Nutritional deficiency with iron, B12, and folate is the most common. So, for example, vegans, vegetarians, one of the things that they need to be very aware of is where they're getting their folate and B12 from, because traditionally the greatest amounts that you get of this is out of meat. So there are not saying that there aren't other ways to get these products, but just someone who's newly moving into a vegetarian diet always needs to be very aware to do it. In India, with the high rates of vegetarianism, do you tend to see much anemia? Yeah. Oh yes, I know, yeah. But I mean within the Hindu communities, you see it a bit more. Oh, okay. Okay, yes. Yes. Oh, okay. Because that's one thing I used to tell my daughter, because both my daughters are vegan, cook in the cast iron pot. Yeah. So one thing it's not in here, but I know from when I talked about there's hemi and non-hemi iron. So hemi iron comes from meat products, non-hemi iron comes from vegetable products. And if you want to absorb non-hemi iron, all you have to do is take vitamin C, like have an orange slice with for both. Still, even for hemi iron, it's better. Okay. Oh, okay, I didn't realize it was meat as well. I thought it was just vegetables. So that's why it's always nice to have some. Yeah. Lemon juice, orange juice helps. Iron is for hemoglobin, of course, as I said, because remember hemoglobin is what carries the O2. And without it, then you tend to have problems. Menstruating women, pregnant women, growing children, and those of lower socioeconomic groups and older adults are the most common for it. Many menstruating women tend to have anemia to some degree, simply because there's blood loss all the time, right? Every month. So, there's some way to do it. Now, there's many ways to take supplements that can happen as well, as far as that goes. But you have to be careful with B12. You don't want to take a lot of B12 because it has bad side effects if you get too much of it in your body. So it's about balance as far as that goes. Conditions that block or interfere with B12 absorption, such as bariatric surgery, intestinal bacterial overgrowth, reduced acid production from antacids, and/or excessive alcohol can cause deficiencies of B12, which results in the problems with it. Gastric parietal cells secrete intrinsic factor that, once in the duodenum, binds to newly released B12, and mucosal cells in the ileum absorb that B12 IF complex because B12 can't be absorbed without it, as far as that goes. One of the problems is when we look at intrinsic factor, people who have stomach issues and take Prevacid and all these medications that are now out there, well, they have problems because it gets blocked. So it's one of the side effects of taking it. Pernicious anemia is caused by autoantibodies that block the formation of the B12 IF complex. And pernicious anemia has to be dealt with a whole other different ways, not just diet. Folate is similar to B12. A deficiency can result from inadequate dietary intake, chronic alcoholism, malabsorption syndromes, medications, and anorexia. Anorexia is not the disease. Anorexia just means what? Don't feel like eating. Anorexia nervosa is the condition by where people starve themselves. But anorexia just means I'm not hungry. Pregnant women can need twice the normal amount for the fetus. And this is why I think it's pretty much standard practice. If a woman goes to her doctor, says I'm pregnant, they immediately start folate. Do it anyways. Anemia of chronic disease is the result of inflammation, and inflammation, of course, does cause a bit of a reduction in hemoglobin, but it can also be from chronic kidney disease, because EPO kind of initially gets stimulated and is part of the kidney itself. So kidney disease can result in reduced erythropoietin. How does it manifest? It generally has to do with how much erythrocyte loss there is, and therefore the severity. Mild anemia, you're a little bit tired once in a while. But as you progress, you may see muscle weakness, dyspnea on exertion, easy fatigue, change of color skin to pallor, tachycardias, and increased angina if it's already existing. If you have hemolysis, because we're now talking about the liver and whatnot, you're going to see jaundice, splenomegaly, and possibly even gallstones as a result of that. Mild iron deficiency can produce symptoms of irritability, lack of exercise tolerance, and headaches. Dementia, ataxia, psychosis, and peripheral neuropathies can develop in B12 deficiencies. You guys know what ataxia is? I know they do. Ataxia? You walk funny. You can't, your gait, yeah. Treatment of anemia is directed toward alleviating or controlling the causes, relieving the symptoms, and preventing complications. So you're going to see a lot of it. It's going to be out there. And the key thing to know about this is when your patient comes to you and says, I have it, you know, what can I do? You might want to have, you know, at some point have a discussion around maybe B12 supplements and causes for it and all that kind of stuff. Okay, leukemias. This is malignant neoplasms of the